able to introduce John Schwartz. Professor Schwartz is a graduate of Berkeley. He's also a MacArthur Fellow, and he is the Harold Brown Professor of Theoretical Physics at California Institute of Technology. Professor Schwartz is one of the founders, pioneers of superstring theory, and so I can't think of anybody better qualified to be able to discuss today with you superstring theory, past, present, and future. Professor John Schwartz.
Thank you, Howard. It's a pleasure to be here in Waterloo. I'm impressed how this part of the world is being placed on the map of theoretical physics with the establishment of the Perimeter Institute, which I'm sure most of you are aware is being constructed across the street. Howard was kind enough to show me that site yesterday and to describe the fantastic plans that they have for the future here. So that's very, very delightful. So today I'd like to describe for you a subject that I've been involved with for a long time called superstring theory, and I'll describe it from a historical perspective, as the title indicates. When I put these transparencies up, I can't see how they're projected. I can only see them here, and so I don't know whether the entire material is actually visible to you. So if something seems to be going off the top or the bottom, just let me know. So on this transparency, I outline what I intend to talk about. So there'll be three more or less equal parts to this discussion. And in the first part, I want to give you a quick overview of how the subject arose in the late 1960s, how it evolved through its first 25 years, how the goal of the program changed at one point, and then to convince you that it's a very active subject, I will discuss some of the highlights of what's happened in the last 10 years, and there have been a lot of exciting developments. And then I also want to convince you that there are a lot of things we don't understand yet, so I will discuss some of the important problems that we still hope to address in the future. So the subject arose in the late 1960s in an attempt to describe one of the forces, fundamental forces in nature. And there are four known forces. There's the gravitational force, there's the electromagnetic force. These are the most familiar. But there are also nuclear forces, the strong and weak nuclear forces, or the way we refer to them. And the strong nuclear force is the one that's responsible for holding protons and neutrons together inside the nucleus of an atom. And it's also the force that's responsible for holding quarks together inside the protons and neutrons. In any case, in the late 60s, we did not have a theoretical understanding of this force. And this was a period when I was a graduate student, and we were trying to develop one. And in the course of this work, the idea arose that a good way of describing the particles that undergo these strong nuclear forces would be to imagine that they were held together by little strings. So the quarks were envisaged as being on the ends of little strings, which were holding them together. And this was a radical departure from existing theories at the time, in that other approaches to understanding fundamental interactions of elementary particles were always based on the idea that the particles should be mathematical points without any spatial extension. And so here we had objects that were extended in one dimension. So when we speak of strings, we don't mean ordinary strings, obviously, but what we mean are just objects that have just one spatial dimension, and they can move around more or less as ordinary strings do. So it was realized that that this kind of a theory was able to capture many of the qualitative features that had turned up in experimental studies of the strong nuclear force. And one of the basic ideas in this picture was that the different nuclear particles could be understood in terms of different ways in which this string could oscillate. So the string undergoes various kinds of motions, and the different motions would be manifested as different particles. So that was the basic idea. So it's a unifying principle, because the idea that a single kind of object, namely the string, could explain many different particles seemed like a nice idea. But this program was not fully successful, and there were certain features of it which disagreed with what was known about the strong nuclear force, and I will mention some of them in a moment. And so a lot of people stopped working on this in the early 70s. So about 5 years after the subject started, it came more or less to a grinding halt. And one of the reasons, besides the fact that it wasn't working completely right, was that another theory was developed called quantum chromodynamics, or abbreviated QCD. And this QCD theory did a brilliant job of describing the strong nuclear force. So there was absolutely no use for string theory at that point. So it fell out of favor, as seems very reasonable. But some of us kept working on it anyway. So what were some of these problems that made it bad? Well, the original version of string theory had the peculiar feature that it only was mathematically consistent if space-time had 26 dimensions. And this exceeds the observed number by a rather large amount. As you know, there are three space dimensions and one time dimension, and this theory had 22 extra space dimensions for which we had absolutely no use. So that was disturbing. Another disturbing fact was that of the known elementary particles, they fall into two very broad categories called bosons and fermions. And many of the most important particles are the fermions. So the quarks that I was referring to earlier and the electrons are examples of particles that are fermions. And yet this original string theory didn't account for any fermions. It only had bosons. So it was missing half the known types of particles. So that was bad. So in 1971, in an attempt to do better, a new string theory was developed in work starting with Pierre Raymond and then also by André Neveu and myself, in which we developed a second string theory, which did have fermions. So that was good. And also it made quite a bit of progress on this problem of the dimensions, because it only required 10 dimensions. So this was a big step in the right direction. As it turned out, this string theory that we found at this time had some other interesting properties that arose in connection with the issue of incorporating fermions, and that was that it had a new type of symmetry, which was not known at the time, and took some time to understand, and this new kind of symmetry was called supersymmetry. And so when I speak of superstrings, as I will be doing, the super is short for supersymmetric. So superstring theories are theories that have this supersymmetry property. Another problem that both the 26-dimensional theory and the 10-dimensional theory had was that when you looked at these excitations, the different ways of different kinds of oscillation that the string could undergo, and looked at the types of particles that they described, there were always examples of particles that had no mass. And in describing the strong nuclear force, this was very bad, because all the particles that do experience strong nuclear forces were known to have mass. And so having particles without mass was not what we wanted. So those were some of the problems and issues of the time. Now, one of these massless particles had an intriguing property, and that if you looked very precisely at exactly how it behaved and dropped your preconceptions about what you were trying to do, one realized that this particle had exactly the properties to describe the gravitational force. So if you take the theory of gravity as developed by Einstein in the early part of the 20th century, and you try to interpret it as a quantum theory, you find that there should be a particle that transmits the gravitational force. And this particle has very specific properties, one of which is that it's massless. The fact that it's massless implies, for example, that the force is propagated with the speed of light, just like the electromagnetic force is. And so, in 1974, Joel Shirk and I proposed that the goal of string theory should be changed. We should forget about describing the strong nuclear force. That wasn't working. But here we had a theory that had the gravity built into it. So we should stop talking about strong nuclear force and start talking about gravity. And it also had many of the features of the other known forces of the time. And so we suggested that it could also give a unified theory of all forces. And the strong nuclear force would be just one of them. So by making this proposal, it was immediately clear that it solved two big problems, at least. Well, one is it gave a role for these massless particles that had been bothering us. So that was important, a very positive thing. Secondly, people had given some thought at that time to how one would reconcile the theory of gravity with the quantum mechanics. And that had turned out to be extremely difficult. All these straightforward ideas based on analogies of studies and other theories led to inconsistencies when you try to include gravity. Specifically, what would happen is the calculations for physical observable quantities would give infinite answers, and that just doesn't make sense. Such theories are called non-renormalizable, a technical term for theories that give these meaningless infinities. But string theory did not have that property. It was giving finite answers. So kind of by chance, without really setting out to do that, we stumbled upon this theory that described gravity and did not have these nasty infinities. So that was good. Another nice thing about using string theory to describe gravity, as well as other forces, is that the problem of the extra dimensions was cast in a very different light. When you're describing just strong nuclear forces, having these extra 6 or 22 or however many dimensions just doesn't make sense, as I said earlier. However, in gravity, the story is quite different. And that is the structure of Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is his gravity theory, which is incorporated in this string theory picture, has the property that the gravitational force is described in terms of the geometry of space-time. So the basic idea is that when you have an object with mass, which is creating a gravitational field, the effect of that is to curve the space and time in the vicinity of that object. So once you get reconciled to the idea that there can be geometry associated with space and time, it's not so wild an extrapolation to imagine that you could make your peace with these extra dimensions by supposing that they somehow curled up into some very tiny space, sufficiently tiny to have evaded observations until now. So the picture we would have is that, say, the 10 dimensions of superstring theory would consist of the four ordinary dimensions of space and time that we're familiar with, times an extra six-dimensional space, which is very tiny. So associated at every point in ordinary space would be some very tiny six-dimensional space attached, which was so small that you couldn't ordinarily see it. Perhaps future high-energy experiments might be able to observe them. They haven't been observed yet. So that was the idea that we put forward in 1974, and we were very excited about it. But for reasons that I still can't understand, it took a decade for other people to take it seriously. So in 1984 was a period now referred to as the first superstring revolution. And at that time, I had been collaborating for about 5 years with Michael Green from Cambridge, England. And we had been working together off and on for that 5-year period. And our collaboration culminated with a discovery that we were pretty excited about, which was that in our emerging, developing understanding of superstring theory, it had been observed by others and by ourselves that there was a potential inconsistency. And this inconsistency was one that arises in theories that are not invariant under mirror reflection. So what does that mean? The idea is, if you looked at the world in a mirror, would the world that you saw in the mirror satisfy the same equations as the world that you describe ordinarily? Or could you tell there was something wrong with it because it was in a mirror? Say, if you knew that everyone in the world was supposed to be right-handed and you noticed that they were all left-handed, then you'd say something's wrong. Well, it turns out that the theories can also be right-handed or left-handed. And when they are, there are potential inconsistencies with quantum mechanics. So what we discovered was that among all the infinite number of symmetry structures that these theories might have associated with them, there were only two for which this inconsistency was avoided. And these are this kind of technical stuff, but they go by the names of SO32 and EA times EA. I'll just refer to them as O and E subsequently. I won't try to explain what those symbols mean. Now, and at that time, we actually had a theory that incorporated this O symmetry, the SO32, which we called type 1. And immediately following our work, there was a group of four physicists in Princeton who became known as the Princeton String Quartet. And what they did was to develop two more superstring theories, which they called heterotic theories, borrowing some jargon from biology. And these two heterotic theories incorporated these two types of symmetries. So by the time the dust settled in 1985, we were left with five consistent superstring theories: the type 1 theory, two type 2 theories, which I hadn't mentioned yet, and these two heterotic theories, which I'm listing here as HE and HO. And each of these five theories requires 10 space-time dimensions. And so when I say 10 space-time dimensions, I always mean 9 space dimensions and 1 time dimension. We never monkey with a number of time dimensions. So we had 5 consistent superstring theories, which was very exciting. And at this point, lots of people got involved in this business. It became a very active area of theoretical physics, which has remained ever since. Now, we were delighted to have 5 theories that were consistent, or seemed to be consistent as best we could understand, but we really only wanted 1 theory. So this was almost too good. So I will return to the question about that shortly. So as more people got involved in studying this business, various surprising discoveries were made, which go by various strange names. So one of these discoveries is called T-duality. And this is important for 2 reasons. One is it shows that not all these theories are different. It's going to give us a couple of equivalences, reducing our list of theories to a smaller list. But in addition to that, it's going to show that our notions about the geometry of space may have to be modified at short distances. So what T-duality did was to show that 2 different geometries for these compact extra dimensions can actually be physically equivalent. And this is very unintuitive, as much of this stuff is. I should say that, to interrupt myself, that over the past 100 years, there have been a lot of surprising discoveries in theoretical physics. In the early part of the 20th century, you had the discovery of relativity, which had all these surprising features about things getting shorter when they went faster and stuff like that. And then there was the quantum theory, which had all sorts of non-intuitive, bizarre phenomena associated with it. And string theory is sort of a similar type. It's introducing us to the idea that there can be further bizarre and unexpected physical phenomena when you go to extremes of high energy and short distances. So what T-duality exhibits is, as an example, is that a circle of radius r. So imagine that one of these extra dimensions forms a circle, side radius r. And then the claim is that that can be equivalent to having a circle of a different radius. And that different radius is a very special value. There's a fundamental length scale in the theory, which I'm calling L here, which is the typical length of the string. So there's a natural length scale associated with a string, L. And so we can form another distance as L squared divided by R. So that's also a distance. And so the claim is that a circle of that radius is equivalent to a circle of the original radius. However, in making this equivalence, it's not just that it gives the same physics in a given theory, but it relates two different theories. So to be explicit about that, use my pen as a pointer here. In the, if I take this heterotic theory and this heterotic theory, if I imagine that in one of them we have an extra dimension forming a circle of radius r, that's equivalent to taking the other heterotic theory with a circle with radius L squared over R. And similarly, for the two type 2 theories, we have this same kind of equivalence with the radius R being equivalent to this L squared over R radius in the other theory. Now, how can that be? You imagine that if you were very small, you could go and look at that thing and measure it with your tape measure, and you would see how big it was. So clearly, for this kind of thing to be possible, our usual ideas of geometry must be breaking down at distances that get as short as this fundamental string length scale, L. You may wonder, how small is this distance L that I'm talking about? And we're not sure about it, but our best guess these days that distance is close to a distance which is known as the Planck length. And the Planck length is a distance first computed by Planck, because he was the person who introduced Planck's constant, which appears in quantum mechanics. And using Planck's constant and Newton's constant, which characterizes gravity and the speed of light, one can put together a number that has the dimensions of length in a unique way. And if you compute what that length is, it's an extraordinarily short distance. In exponential notation, it's 10 to the minus 32 centimeters. But just to give you an idea of how small that is, that's as much smaller than an atom as an atom is smaller than the solar system. It's a very short distance. But at that distance scale, if that's the right scale, usual geometric concepts are breaking down. So that concludes my first part on what I call the past. Now, what I call the present includes the past 10 years. And so that's 1994 until the present. And this has been a period of important discoveries, often referred to as the second superstring revolution, particularly the early part of this period. And there have been many important contributors, and I've listed a few of their names here. Edward Witten stands out as should be first on any list. And Ashok Sen, Natty Seiberg, Chris Hull, Paul Townsend, Joe Polchinski, Andy Strominger, Kumaran Bapa. These are some of the people who have made very important contributions to our understanding of these issues. So one of the discoveries in this period of the second superstring revolution is a second duality, which sounds something like this first one that I described that I call T-duality. Incidentally, these letters, T and S, have absolutely no significance. They're just names. So S-duality is a second kind of equivalence, which again relates pairs of theories. But the way the two theories differ that are being related is not by the size of an extra dimension, but in this case, by the strength of the interaction. So in any string theory, strings can interact, and there's some number that tells you how strongly they interact. This number is usually represented by the symbol G, so the coupling strength. So when G is much smaller than 1, we say that the theory is weakly coupled. If G is much larger than 1, we say it's strongly coupled. And when it's much less than one, we know how to compute things, because there's a method for computing where you first compute the terms which are proportional to g, then you compute corrections that are proportional to g squared, and corrections which are proportional to g cubed, and so forth. And doing things that way, which is called perturbation theory, is numerically very good if g is small. But if g is not small, it's not so good. Well, anyway, what this S-duality did was to relate pairs of theories by relating g in one theory to 1 over g in the other theory. So that means that so in particular, the type 1 superstring theory and the O-type heterotic theory, the HO theory, are related by this S-duality property. So that means if we understood the type 1 theory with an interaction strength of 1 over 100, which is a very weak interaction, that would be equivalent to understanding this other theory with an interaction strength of 100, which was a very strong interaction. So strong interaction in one theory is equivalent to weak interaction in the other. And prior to this, we only understood how to compute weakly interacting theories. So this gave us a handle on how to compute strongly interacting theories. So since we understand both of these theories for weak coupling, this duality tells us how to interpret both of them when the interactions are strong. It does not tell us how to study them when they're in between. G is around 1, and we're still stuck. But in the 2 limits, it gives us the second limit. So for this other theory, the 2B, it's actually duality to itself. So the 2B theory with weak coupling is equivalent to the 2B theory with strong coupling. So the consequence of this is that we have another equivalence of theories, so the type 1 and the O-type heterotic theory. So we put this together with the equivalences we had from the T-duality, and our list of theories that are genuinely different is shrinking. And putting together a few more dualities that I won't tell you about, we can relate all 5 of the string theories that we had. And so the conclusion is that really they just correspond to different limiting cases of a single underlying theory. So we're now in the happy position where we feel that there's a completely unique underlying theory, and it just manifests itself so that it's 5 different superstring theories in 5 different limiting cases. Now, what I just told you about S-duality raises a couple of questions. The S-duality property told us how 3 of the 5 theories behave when the coupling is strong by relating them to theories of weak coupling. But there were 2 more theories, namely the 2A theory and the E-type heterotic theory. So a natural question is, what happens to these 2 theories when the interaction strength gets very large? And the answer came as quite a surprise to all of us, but it's established beyond a shadow of a doubt as being correct. And that is, what happens when the interactions get strong in these 2 string theories is that they grow in 11th dimension, not just 10th dimension anymore. They become 11th dimensional. And the size of the 11th dimension is proportional to this interaction strength G times the string length scale that gives it the right dimensions. So we get a length size. So if G is 100, say, very strong coupling, then this extra dimension would have the size of 100 times the fundamental string length scale. So the 2 theories are different, the 2A and the E-type heterotic theory. In the case of the 2A theory, this 11th dimension, this extra 11th dimension, is a circle. But in the case of the E-type heterotic theory, the extra dimension is actually just a line interval with 2 ends. So it's as if you cut this circle open. Now, having 2 ends means that that you have an 11-dimensional region with 2 10-dimensional faces, if you can visualize that. Now, this 11-dimensional theory has been named M-theory by Edward Witten, and he introduced the letter M in this connection with the idea that it might stand for magical or mysterious, because there are many things we don't understand about the 11-dimensional limit. Other people have suggested that it could stand for other things, such as if you think it has to do with the underlying unified theory, it might be the mother of all theories. That's another possibility. What, as we became able to understand what was going on in these theories, when the interactions were not weak, we realized that they had other objects besides the fundamental strings. People used to ask me when I gave lectures long ago, why do you only consider strings? Why don't you consider objects with two dimensions, like membranes, or three-dimensional planes, or whatever? And I always used to say, well, that doesn't work. Only strings work. Well, in fact, we now understand things better. And these were good questions. And these theories do have objects of various dimensions in them, which have been called P-brains. So, I didn't make up this nomenclature. P is supposed to be a number. So a string in this language would be a one brain, indicating it's one dimension. A point particle would be a zero brain, and a membrane would be a two brain, and so forth. But when you have 10 dimensions, you can have very high dimensional brains. So there can be there are five brains in the 11 dimensional theory, for example. Now, these strings do have a special property. So we weren't completely wrong in ignoring the P-brains. And that is that when the interaction string, which I call G, becomes very small, when the theory is very weakly coupled, all the P-brains become very heavy. So their masses or their energy densities become infinite in the limit that G goes to zero. And that's true for all the objects except for the fundamental strings. So in the limit where you turn off the interactions, only the fundamental strings survive as objects of finite mass. But if the G is not small, if it's comparable to one, then all these objects have comparable energy densities in the appropriate units. And in that regime, I think it's fair to say that all these P-brains are just as important as the fundamental strings. Now, there's a special class of P-brains that has particularly interesting properties. And this special class are called D-brains. The D, in this case, doesn't stand for a number. It stands for Dirichlet, which is the name of a mathematician. And these D-brains have the property that's really their defining property, that strings can end on them. So if you imagine, say, think of a two-dimensional surface as being a D-brain, and a string can have one end of it just attached to that surface. Ordinarily, the strings are just closed loops, but in the presence of D-brains, they can open up and have ends that are attached to the D-brains. And it turns out that one consequence of this fact, and it's kind of a long story to explain why, but one consequence of this fact is that quantum field theories of the type that describe QCD and describe the other forces, like the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear forces, these are theories of a special type called the Yang-Mills type. And these types of theories are reproduced beautifully by open strings ending on D-brains. So when you have D-brains floating around in space, then you can get just the kind of theories you need to describe the non-gravitational forces associated to those D-brains. And that's a very active area of research these days, trying to explain how you can configure D-brains to reproduce the standard model of various forces. There are many ideas that are giving qualitatively correct results, but I think it's fair to say that no one has exactly the right solution yet. Now, there was another major breakthrough in November of 1997 by Juan Maldacena, who was at Harvard at the time. He's now at the Institute for Advanced Study. And it was a brilliant breakthrough, really. He conjectured another kind of duality, which no one had considered previously. And this is a duality that relates more conventional quantum field theories, like those in the standard model and in QCD and so on, and relates them to string theories for very special types of space-time geometries. So here I've gotten a little bit technical and named the theories in question. So there's a particular quantum field theory called N equal 4 super Yang-Mills theory, and that was one that occurred as the particular quantum field theory he was considering. And that, according to his conjecture, was precisely equivalent to the type 2b superstring theory, provided that the superstring theory was operating in a 10-dimensional space-time, where the 10-dimensional space-time could be thought of as having five extra dimensions forming a five-dimensional sphere, and the other five dimensions forming a negatively curved space-time called anti-de Sitter space in five dimensions. So it's a rather peculiar geometry, not one you would otherwise be led to consider, perhaps. Certainly unrealistic, and there's no claim this is realistic, but it's theoretically interesting. This was a tremendous insight, because for one thing, it told us that a theory in four dimensions could be equivalent to our theory in 10 dimensions. And moreover, it told us that a theory based just on point particles, which these quantum field theories are, could be equivalent to this 10-dimensional theory based on strings. So this came as quite a shock to me, because all my life I've been going around telling people you couldn't describe gravity with ordinary quantum field theory. But now it turns out ordinary quantum field theory is equivalent to string theory, at least in a special situation. So they caught me. Okay. So how can that be? Well, the five-dimensional sphere can be very small. It doesn't play much of a role in the story, except for certain details. But this five-dimensional infinite space, this anti-de Sitter space, can be thought of as having a four-dimensional boundary. And this quantum field theory can be thought of as living on that four-dimensional boundary. So you have a situation that people call holography. So what is ordinary holography? You take a picture of the three-dimensional world on a two-dimensional photograph, but you see three dimensions if you look at this two-dimensional photograph. So the idea is that you can capture five-dimensional physics on a four-dimensional snapshot. And that's roughly what this equivalence in Montesina is achieving. So this is called a holographic duality for that reason. And this duality is sometimes referred to as ADS-CFT duality. So the ADS stands for this anti-de Sitter space, which appears here. The CFT refers to the fact that this quantum field theory, this N equal 4 super Yang-Mills theory, has a very special feature. It's what's called a conformally invariant field theory. What those words mean, basically, is that there's no natural length scale in the theory, and the theory looks the same at all scales. Well, this proposal of Montesina gave rise to a couple thousand subsequent publications, and if you're interested in them, they can all be found on the ePrint archives, which are found at archive.org. And many of these papers have made important breakthroughs. And so this subject has been developed very far, very quickly, by lots of clever people. But I think I've said enough about it already. So let me turn to the final part of my talk, which is to tell you about some of the things that we haven't solved, problems we would like to solve. I should probably preface these remarks, by saying that whenever there is a breakthrough in string theory in the past, we've always been led to ask new questions that we hadn't thought of asking previously. And so this list of remaining problems is undoubtedly incomplete, and if we ever solve one of them, we will probably add more to the list. So our experience is that the list is getting longer rather than shorter. In any case, here are some of the important problems. I mentioned that we have five different limiting superstring theories, which are different limits of a single underlying theory. But what we don't have is a compelling formulation of this underlying theory. We're not sure how important this is. We would certainly love to find an elegant, simple mathematical formula that captured the whole story, and we don't have that yet. Not having it doesn't stop us from going about our business, but it would at the very least be very satisfying if we could find such a formula. Analogous formulas certainly exist in prior theories, like general relativity. Einstein has a beautiful formula associated with that. So that's one important issue. Another issue has to do with an important discovery and an issue that Einstein worried about. And this has to do with a quantity called the cosmological constant. And the cosmological constant is a measure of the energy density of empty space. Now, I always thought that if space was empty, there was no energy density there. And so it came as a shock to discover there can be. And that's what this cosmological constant is able to describe. When Einstein first introduced it, it wasn't in his original version of general relativity, but a year later, he introduced it to try to solve certain cosmological problems, which is why he called it the cosmological constant. And then later, he renounced it as the worst mistake he ever made. Well, the fact of the matter is that it is mathematically possible. And moreover, recent studies in astrophysics and cosmology give very strong evidence that there really is one. So there really is an energy density associated with empty space. In fact, there's so much that if you look at the complete energy budget of the universe, it accounts for about 70%. So it's a lot. So this energy has been referred to recently as dark energy. And so that's a lot of energy described by this cosmological constant. But it's really difficult for us to deal with theoretically. Expressed in these Planck units that I was referring to earlier, it's actually a very small number. So even though it's a major part of the energy of the universe, in natural units, it's an extremely small quantity. And we would be happy as a first approximation to explain why it was zero, even though that's not the right answer. That should be completely adequate for understanding all of particle physics. So this non-zero value of the cosmological constant only becomes important when you want to understand the evolution of the universe. And that, of course, would be a great thing to do. But if you have this more modest goal of understanding particle physics, then you can probably manage without it. But not only do we not understand why it has this small non-zero value, we also don't understand why it's almost zero. So this is an issue that we've worried about for about 20 years now. There have been a lot of clever suggestions, but nothing's really caught on, and I suspect the right one is still to be found. Now, another important issue is that when you have a physical theory, which is described, say, by some beautiful equation, the beautiful equation doesn't describe nature. What describes nature is a solution to the equation. So you have to solve your equation, and that's what describes nature. And a single beautiful equation that has no adjustable parameters, is completely unique, might have lots and lots of different solutions. And that's the situation we seem to be in with string theory. We have a completely unique theory, but every indication is that it has an enormous number of different solutions. And so this raises the whole question, which is the right solution and why is it the right solution? And we don't know. In the quantum context, instead of talking about solutions to equations, we talk about finding the quantum vacuum. But that's sort of the same thing recast in different language. So we want to find the quantum solution that describes all the particle physics and understand whether it is a special in the sense that it has some theoretical feature that singles it out, or whether it just happens to be the one universe we inhabit, arbitrarily selected. So we might call it an environmental accident. And we just don't know that. So that's one of the questions we would certainly like to understand. There are various issues associated with black holes. Black holes are fascinating quantities, and there's been some progress in understanding their properties in string theory. Hawking made important work on black holes and how they fit together with quantum mechanics in the 1970s. He discovered that black holes can actually radiate due to quantum mechanical properties, and they have thermodynamic properties, so they're characterized by a temperature and an entropy and so forth. And there's been progress in string theory in actually computing some of these thermodynamic properties of black holes from first principles, so that's been very exciting. But Hawking also pointed out that with black holes, there's a danger of a breakdown of quantum mechanics. And string theory has really been formulated in such a way that one of the bedrocks on which it rests is quantum mechanics, something we hold sacred and haven't contemplated giving up. So in string theory, quantum mechanics is exact. And so if Hawking is right that black holes lead to a breakdown of quantum mechanics, then there's a tension in string theory. Well, string theory respects quantum mechanics. It describes black holes. So Hawking must be wrong. But the fact of the matter is that no one has been able to explain in detail exactly where his mistake was. So if he made a mistake, it's a very subtle one. Another issue associated with black holes is that the space and time get infinitely curved when you go to the center of the black hole. You have what's called a space-time singularity. And in classical general relativity, the Einstein theory of gravity, having this infinite curvature, it represents an inconsistency of the theory. Now, it's likely that string theory makes sense of this kind of singularity, but we don't understand yet how that works. So that there are important issues there that need to be addressed as well. So, as my advertising blurb indicated, there are two big problems. One is understanding particle physics, and the other is understanding the universe. And we hope that string theory has relevance to understanding the universe as well. So it's supposed to be very good when you're dealing with things that are very small or things that are very big. Probably less useful in between. And here again, one can ask same type of question that arose in connection with particle physics. But now when you talk about the evolution of the universe, what you're doing is you're looking for solutions to the theory which are time dependent, which are changing with time. When we were trying to describe particle physics, we had in mind looking for solutions that were static and not changing with time. So we're looking for a different kind of solutions here to describe the evolution of the universe. And we know very little about time-dependent solutions in string theory. It turns out that it's very challenging mathematically to understand them. And that's sort of a subject in its infancy. It's getting a lot of attention in the last few years, but I think it's fair to say that it's a subject in need of a breakthrough. So, I have spared you much of the mathematics of this business, but as you're probably aware, this is a subject that involves a lot of mathematics. And so I've listed as a final issue that we probably need to develop more mathematical tools and concepts in order to solve all the previous problems that I've listed. We find ourselves up against the frontiers of most major branches of mathematics. And so given our experience to date, I think there's little doubt that future developments are going to utilize many mathematical tools and concepts that do not currently exist. So this is challenging on the one hand, but it's very healthy and exciting that we're getting a very good interaction with the mathematics community. Physics and mathematics had kind of drifted apart in much of the 20th century, and they're really coming back together, and it's very pleasing to see. So, to conclude, I would say that we've made a lot of progress in understanding string theory in the last 30 years, but when I talk to prospective graduate students who are considering going into the subject, I always tell them that they needn't be worried that the problems will all be solved before they get a chance to contribute. And so I'm sure that in 30 years from now, there will still be a long list of unsolved problems. Thank you.
we have quite a bit of time for questions, and we have people on this side and this side for questions. If you just hold up your hand and wait until the person with the mic comes to you, that would be great, and Professor Schwartz can answer.
Hello. I've heard many critics who've spoken about string theory, and they have said that string theory hasn't produced any numbers that can be verified in the laboratory. How do you respond to those kinds of charges?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's true. We haven't produced any numbers that have been tested in the laboratory. So I agree with that sentiment. There's a very simple reason why it's difficult for us to confront experiment. And that is that this natural length scale that I mentioned, this Planck length, is such this incredibly short distance. And this number is constructed just out of Planck's constant, Newton's constant, and the speed of light. So any theory that unifies quantum mechanics, relativity, and gravity is going to have this number in it. To probe those short distances requires experiments at extraordinarily high energies because of the properties of quantum mechanics. And to just indicate how high, the highest energy accelerator experiments that are currently underway are at a 1,000 electron volts, a TeV. And those are able to probe distances that are about 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. And the distance scales that I was talking about are some 15 orders of magnitude beyond that. So they're very far from being observable. However, I should add a number of remarks here. So if you buy this scenario that that's the right length scale, the question is, are there predictions that one can make at observable energies? And one feature that string theory has had from the beginning is the supersymmetry that I alluded to earlier. And that's a very important feature, which I didn't have time to go into, and also I chose not to because it gets a little bit technical. But this symmetry predicts that for every known particle, there should be an associated partner particle with similar properties. And so a natural question is, where are these particles? Why haven't we seen them? And we believe the answer is, first of all, that this symmetry is what we call a broken symmetry. And when you have a broken symmetry, the partner particles need not have exactly the same mass as the partners. So, for example, the quarks are supposed to have supersymmetry partner particles, which have been named squarks. And the electron is supposed to have a partner particle, which has been named a selectron. Well, the squarks and the selectrons and various other particles with funny names haven't been found yet. But we have a rough idea where we think the mass of these things should be. And we think that the mass should be somewhere between 100 billion and a trillion electron volts. So that puts them right at the range where they should be observable at the accelerator, which is being constructed in Geneva, Switzerland now. There's a lab called CERN where they're building a machine called the Large Hadron Collider, which is supposed to be completed in 2007. Should have data and results a year or two after that. And I think it's better than 50-50 chance that they will find these supersymmetry particles. If they do, this would be, in my opinion, an enormous success for string theory. It would be an exciting discovery irrespective of string theory. It would set the agenda for experimental particle physics for several decades to come, because as soon as you find one of these partner particles, you know that all the other partners have got to exist too, and you'll want to study them, produce them, analyze them, see how they behave. And so that would be very exciting. So I think supersymmetry is the best candidate for some discovery in the reasonably near term that wouldn't prove that string theory was right, but would be an important confirmation that we're on the right track at least.
Hi. How do these extra dimensions work?
Okay. So when you have a solution, we got to solve the equation. So there's some equations I haven't shown you, and you have to solve them. So these extra dimensions, which form some funny geometry, it can't be just an arbitrary geometry. It has to be one that solves the equations. And back in the mid-80s, when people were trying to make realistic models based on one of the five superstring theories, it was realized that one could get things that came very close to being realistic at low energies if, for the extra six dimensions, one chose a very special type of geometry. And this special type of geometry had the property, first of all, that it solved the equations, which is very non-trivial, and secondly, that it gave just the right amount of supersymmetry at observable energies. And so this type of six-dimensional space is named for two mathematicians. It's called a Calabi-Yau space. And there are actually many different Calabi-Yau spaces. It's a big subject in mathematics. And the detailed description of these kinds of six-dimensional geometries is a highly technical mathematical subject. There are other geometries for the extra dimensions that people are exploring. For example, when you start in the 11-dimensional description, you have seven extra dimensions to deal with. And there people talk about even more exotic types of seven-dimensional manifolds. They're even more exotic and obscure than these six-dimensional Calabi-Yau spaces. These seven-dimensional spaces that they consider are ones that are said to have G2 holonomy, which is some mathematical jargon that characterizes them. So that's one of the areas where we're up against the frontiers of mathematics is in the study of these higher dimensional spaces.
Thank you. Rather than going the high energy route and building an accelerator 10 light years long in order to deal with these quantum scales. What about going the other direction and look for modulus forces?
Looking for what?
Modular forces.
I'm not sure that I know what you're referring to.
The vibration of the dimensions, of the compacted six dimensions.
And so this represents some freedom in the solution, which is sometimes referred to as saying that these geometries have moduli. So I don't know if you're referring to that. Another feature is that these extra dimensions have excitations associated with them, so that you see new kinds of particles in the remaining ordinary dimensions, which are ones where there are excitations inside the extra dimensions. These are sometimes referred to as Kaluza-Klein excitations. And there are important issues associated with both of these features of extra dimensions. The moduli problem is a real sticky problem because they seem to imply the existence of massless particles of another type beyond that of the photon and the graviton, which are massless particles that we know and love. But these other massless particles would seem to be in conflict with observation. So to have a realistic setup, it seems likely that we need to find compactifications in which these moduli particles don't occur. And if you just pick some random solutions, there are usually hundreds of them. So this can be a serious problem. But people have gotten more clever in recent years in finding special situations in which they're eliminated. So I think that problem can be overcome. On the problem of the Kaluza-Klein excitations, whether these correspond to particles that can be observed depends on the size of these extra dimensions. And if the size is as small as I indicated, then these Kaluza-Klein excitations would be much too heavy to be observed in accelerators. However, there's been speculation in the last few years that it's conceivable that these extra dimensions might be much, much larger than I said. I don't particularly subscribe to this, but at the same time, I think it's a reasonable attitude to ask what are the experimental limits and what's possible, and then to try to improve them. So in the next round of experiments, besides looking for supersymmetry particles, the experimenters will also be looking for indications of extra dimensions. As I said, I'm optimistic about the supersymmetry particles. I'm not optimistic that they'll find indications of extra dimensions, but if they did, that would be very exciting too, of course. I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Sir? Oh, gotcha. Go ahead.
Dr. Schwartz, you mentioned the use of mathematics quite extensively, but you talked briefly about perturbation theory, but didn't talk about the use of simulation in any aspect of describing a string theory. Does simulation play a role at all, or is it still too complex to figure out how to calculate any kind of detailed calculations at this point?
It's certainly true that almost all the progress that's been achieved in string theory has been through analytic work and not through numerical studies. There have been occasionally questions that have arisen where people have contemplated doing numerical simulations. But what usually happens is that the questions that they're asking have so many degrees of freedom associated with them that the calculations go way beyond what any even modern computer can handle. So it's much better to find clever analytic tricks rather than just brute force.
Hello. Over the years, more and more particles.
I can't see where you are, right here. Okay.
Over the years, more and more particles have been discovered, it seems, by science. Is there any conceivable limit to the number of particles that there may be out there?
Well, I mentioned that in describing the strong interactions, we had the idea that the different modes of oscillation of the string would correspond to the different particles. And I think that's still a qualitatively correct idea. And in that picture, you can have arbitrarily high excitations of the string. So in that picture, you would have an infinite number of possible excitations, just because the string can vibrate in arbitrarily complicated ways. So the unifying simple idea would be that the string is the fundamental object. And then from that viewpoint, you would say it was just one elementary object.
Hello. Oh, there we go. Just over here on your left, just as more of a philosophical question, I teach high school, and my students can't spend 5 minutes on a problem, let alone 30 minutes on a problem. Why on earth would you, after 15 years, and all of a sudden they tell you, oh no, QCD answers all these questions, what made you stick with the problem? Because I know I'm going to talk to my kids today and says, oh, they found a solution back in 73. Why did you stick with it?
Well, I pointed out this work I did with Jean Scherk, where we found the graviton and suggested using the idea for gravity. We did that in 74, so that was just 1 year after. So really the question contracts to why we kept going for 1 year. Maybe we were just slow to catch on to it.
Did the whole effect state, like, was there a continued effort for yourself? Was it more of a pet project because there seemed to be a little bit of, no, it's not there, okay, or did you stay with it?
So following 74, once we bought into the idea that this is the way to reconcile gravity and quantum theory, at that point, I was completely hooked at that point. And there wasn't anything that was going to make me change my mind. And I'm sure Joel felt the same way. Unfortunately, he died around 1980, so he hasn't seen all the exciting things that have happened since then. He was only 30 years, so it's very sad. So as I said in my talk, the thing that I found puzzling was what people needed until 1984, to be convinced. But and at that point, a large number of physicists got involved in this work. During that period of the late 70s, early 80s, there were theoretical physicists working on closely related subjects. So theories that involved supersymmetry but didn't have strings, just quantum field theories with supersymmetry. And much of that work was relevant to what we were doing. And so we did have fruitful interactions with others throughout that period, even though our goals were a little bit different.
So you weren't working at total time?
No. Also, fortunately, I would maintain employment, too.
Okay, we have time for three more questions. Three more questions.
So this is a more general type of question. Increasingly, technology is accelerating, so potentially it can get out of control and maybe blow back on us increasingly. And of course, it's science that enables us to create those and technologies, understand them and their effects and so on. However, within science, there is a great resistance to paradigm shifts. And as it becomes more and more imperative to understand technology and its effects that we've created, that more and more it's going to interact with itself in intelligent ways and so on, we have to be able to change our science so that we can incorporate new viewpoints much more quickly and get beyond these ideas of schools that resist those who try to develop new ideas, etc. So there's sort of an imperative here to overcome our resistance to change with respect to our theories and so on. And among other things, I mean, there's all sorts of things out there, like potentially things like morphogenic fields. Tesla could run things in his head, models in his head, and had explanations for all sorts of phenomena he considered, and many to today, the concept that the ether might have some validity, etc. But in any event, there is a need for paradigm shifts to be allowed in a valid way to occur much more quickly, just for the sake of survival of the species. And do you have any suggestions as to how we might bring about that shift a little more rapidly and appropriately?
Well, I'm trying to figure out how to put your question in the context of what I was talking about. maybe one question is, what should we have done to convince other people to accept our viewpoint more quickly? Whenever there's a departure from accepted ideas, which you call a paradigm shift, there is, of course, natural resistance, unless it has some demonstrated virtues. And I think if you have clever people working in a subject, and in theoretical physics, there are lots of clever people, I think you really can't tell them what to do. They're going to make their own best judgment. And so even though I found it puzzling that there was this resistance to these ideas, I'm not sure what lessons to draw from it.
Well, my question is much less profound. Over here. When you were talking about T-duality, you used as an example that a certain...
I can't tell where you are.
I'm over here. The little person in the back. When you're talking about T-duality, you used the example that a circle of radius R could be equivalent to one of circle of radius L squared over R.
Yes.
And I presume you mean equivalent in some mathematical sense. But I'm wondering if you could explain that a little bit further so that I could understand it.
Okay. So I said there are two different theories. And in one of them, you take the circle that radius r, which might be very small. And the other, you take it at radius l squared over r, which might be very large. And when I said they were equivalent, I meant that you're describing identical physics, that they're indistinguishable. This theory with the radius r and this theory with the radius l squared over r, it's the same thing. Now, you may ask, how can that be? Suppose this radius is a mile around. Surely you could tell that it's not some incredibly tiny distance. And then to explain how that's possible, there's a certain amount of mathematics, which I don't think I should go through right now, but can discuss with you later.
Hello, I'm a layman, although I did study science at university, but I guess what I begin to wonder is when I hear of the work that you and others are doing, it all sounds increasingly complex and bizarre and fantastical. And I would have two questions. First of all, do you think the human brain is really capable of coming to an ultimate understanding of reality? And second, why did it happen that the universe became organized in such an incredibly complicated way?
So on the first question, the answer is, of course, I don't know whether the human brain is capable of figuring all this out. I'm impressed that the community has gotten as far as it has. I'm also amazed that mathematical concepts are so powerful at addressing these issues. It's not obvious why that should be, but it seems to be a fact. On the question of why is nature so complicated, one could take a different viewpoint and say that if the ideas that I was describing are correct, what we are arguing is that there's a unique mathematical structure that's theoretically possible, quite aside from reality. Just as the universe didn't exist and somebody were just pure brain, and you ask, what is mathematically possible? Once you accept a couple basic ideas, quantum mechanics and gravity, that you're pretty much led to these structures that I was just describing.
Well, that seems a wonderful point on which to end this evening's festivities. Before I formally thank our speaker again, I'd like to point out that not only is superstring theory an extremely active area of research worldwide, it's an active area of research right here in Rada Perimeter Institute, and Professor Rob Myers leads the efforts at Perimeter, along with many postdocs and graduate students and visitors and others. So I'd like to thank Professor Schwartz again for a wonderfully stimulating and interesting talk. Thank you very much, Professor Schwartz.